Hello and welcome to the Betches Up podcast. I'm Elise Morales.
I'm Amanda Duberman.
And for those of you who are just tuning in, the Betches Up podcast is your weekly rundown of all the crazy shit that's happened in the news, explained by your two funniest friends,
which is us.
Today we're talking about Mark Zuckerberg,
a gentleman by the name of Bill Taylor,
and a little lady named Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. Let's get into it.
Betches Media presents.
I like beer. I don't know if you do. Okay. Do you like beer, Senator, or not?
My party is going bat crazy.
You're the pup. Alternative facts.
Oh, goodness.
The Betches Sup podcast.
America!
Who would you rather be in an elevator with of those three?
Between Bill Taylor, Mark Zuckerberg, and
definitely
Hillary
Clinton.
Okay, I mean,
Bill Taylor, I would ask him some questions.
Yeah, I mean, Bill Taylor, we'll get into everything, yeah. But he, I'm like attracted to him now.
Me too.
Because of his behavior,
yes.
Recently. So I'm like, I mean, am I single in this scenario?
True.
Like, because if so, Maybe Bill Taylor. And others, if I'm, you know, Happily engaged or married, then I'm going to go with Hillary.
Yeah.
Under no circumstances would I ever want to be in an elevator with Mark Zuckerberg.
That sounds, not even just because he's like a villain, but he just is awkward.
Yeah. I would pry the doors open.
He would be like, how's your day going?
What would you, I feel like you would just be like, oh man, the elevator's broken, and he would just be like powering down and then just like and then you're like alone in an elevator with like a fleshy robot.
I would see him in there, be like, I forgot my chapstick outside.
Yeah.
Have a good day.
Bye.
Like, yeah.
Under no circumstances would I ever want to be.
Right.
Honestly, you're Mark Zuckerberg.
No.
I think now that we've seen him in all of these hearings, which obviously we're going to get into, I think it's, I think we have to go back and redo The Social Network.
I know.
With like not as charming of a person.
Hundy P.
Jesse Eisenberg made him seem like the like most like charming, kind of like, I don't
wonky,
know.
Wonky, nerdy, earnest.
Yeah, he had like Seth Cohen energy.
You were still kind of rooting for him.
Yeah, you're like, no, this guy's smart and cool.
Right.
And maybe he's ruthless, but like it's cool. And then you see him in these testimonies and he's like the like stereotype of like a weird white tech bro.
Totally.
Like no expressionless. He's got, which I've had in the past, the baby bangs.
Yes, that's what I know. That seems that seems new.
Yeah.
That seems like a new style.
Yeah, he has the Lord Farquaad.
Yeah, so weird. It's like a really jagged, looks like a baby.
His haircut
like
was shocking to me.
It was shocking.
So you know what? Let's get into it. Amanda, what?
As you can tell, this is getting us through the week.
Yeah, what's been, different aspects of it are getting us through.
Yeah.
So which aspect of Mark Zuckerberg's testimony is getting you through the week in Trump's America?
Yeah, so I am partial to AOC's grilling of Mark Zuckerberg yesterday. So Mark Zuckerberg was there to discuss Libra, which is their cryptocurrency that they want. But they're getting, like, obviously regulators are pretty concerned, especially given Facebook's past of questionable policies and not really like taking these big things seriously. So that he was there to talk about Libra, but they were like, we're going to talk about all the shit you've already done.
Yes. I'm going to come out right now on the podcast and say, and maybe it'll come back to bite me, I don't think Facebook should have its own money.
I
don't think they should have a legal currency.
No, you think it'd be maybe a bad idea.
I think it would be bad.
Yeah.
I think that given what we know, I actually just think, I feel like independent companies shouldn't have their own money.
Yeah, it's weird.
I feel like that's actually definitely something we should leave to like governments to have.
Yeah. Yeah. So they're saying that like, we're not going to do it unless we have like a thumbs up from US regulators, which I don't know if based on yesterday, I mean, the Congress people are not regulators to that extent, but it was brutal. And like Visa and PayPal apparently like pulled out of being involved at all because they said it was too risky.
Yeah. Right. It seems, I'm not an economist, but it seems like a bad, bad road for
so
us
like,
to go down.
Really grilling into them serve two purposes, which is to talk about like all the shit they're doing right now that is problematic and be like, yeah, this is why they probably shouldn't make money. Like, they let lies in ads, so are they going to do a Libra ad? Like, you want 2,000 Libra?
Right. I mean, well, another thing that's been a big thing about Facebook in sort of, like, the creator space, which definitely affected us here at Betches and affected tons of people I know throughout, like, comedy, is that they artificially inflated their video views.
Yes.
Basically for the purpose of making all these companies invest in Facebook video, taking money away from YouTube, because, like, I mean, I remember when I started comedy, your bread and butter was putting out my videos on YouTube, and you would get maybe 1,000 views, and you were like, this really, like, you'd be like, we did good on here.
Totally.
And then Facebook video came out, and you're getting
crazy
4 to 5 times that amount. So everybody put money into Facebook video.
Everyone pivoted to video. Yes, it was such a bubble.
It's like a term in the media world, pivot to video, which all these companies did, because Facebook was artificially inflating their numbers and making it seem like you were reaching all these thousands of people. Then when they stopped doing that, they pulled the rug out from all these companies. I think we both know people who lost their jobs over it.
I would say that I sort of lost. I was laid off for HuffPost after like the third round of layoffs.
Yeah.
But honestly, it all started with that. An overinvestment in video, and then just trying to salvage all the investment we put into it. And it just like completely, I mean, people changed their entire business model.
Yes,
because it looked like you were being rewarded for these like super viral, honestly kind of vapid videos.
It was, and I mean, I remember being like, well, I'm only going to put my comedy videos on Facebook because they're getting thousands more views.
It was really fun for like 9 months.
You were like, I'm crushing it. Yeah. Like, this video is viral, basically. And then it's like all lies.
Yeah. It was all lies.
It was all lies. It was a career based on lies.
Yeah.
And so just having seen what they did with video views, I don't fucking
trust
them.
The power they have with one move is pretty, pretty scary.
Yeah.
Yeah. What they talk, so also Facebook, I think last week or recently sort of announced a new policy with regard to political speech and political ads, saying that they are going to sort of stuff that is incites violence and is lies, like memes that go around that include lies and hate speech, they're for that a normal person puts up, if it's flagged, they'll fact check it and take it down.
Yeah.
If it's a politician, they will not. Because they claim that like everything a politician says is newsworthy. This might sound familiar because I think we've been hearing a lot about Twitter lately.
Yeah, Twitter that, like, kind of has the same now thing with Donald Trump, that they're like not going to hold him to their standards because anything he says is news.
Yeah, since he's the president. Yeah. And obviously, like, the idea of people lying in political ads, like your company just like oversaw like massive election interference that like had like a cataclysmic effect on the 2016 election, and now you're gonna continue to let people lie.
Yes. And Donald Trump has already put out ads that went up on Facebook, have been seen by millions of people, that include lies about Joe Biden and his involvement in the Ukraine stuff. So, and Facebook is basically saying like, no, the ad has to be preserved for newsworthiness, so we won't take it down. So now a million people have seen something that is actually factually false.
So is this what Elizabeth Warren was doing when she trolled them with that ad?
Yes. Yeah. So basically Elizabeth Warren then bought an ad on Facebook that included false statements about Facebook.
Yeah.
Which I'm just like, I fucking love that so much.
It's so
that
funny.
Rocks. Yeah. And that's what people need to be doing. And that's what I think people did at this. I think the clip you're about to throw to kind of shows someone laying that policy bare.
Yeah, yes.
Someone we all love very
much. Right. So AOC sort of like stole the show. Honestly, every like woman lawmaker, they're the ones I watch but I think they seem to be primarily like, I think they coordinated ahead of time and they just hit him from every angle. Like Maxine Fisher, she's like, my time's up, but I believe my friend is going to continue asking you these questions. But AOC sort of cornered him on the logic of letting lies in ads. So lies about elections or the census are not allowed because that's straight up voter suppression.
Yeah.
It's easy for everybody to see that. Like, but lies, so he sort of tries to explain why, how the company justifies publishing lies.
He certainly tries.
Yes. So we'll play that clip.
Here. Under your policy, you know, using census data as well, could I pay to target predominantly black zip codes and advertise them the incorrect election date?
No, Congresswoman, you couldn't.
But you said you're not going to fact check my ads.
We have, if anyone, including a politician, is saying things that can cause, that is calling for violence or could risk imminent physical harm or voter or census suppression when we roll out the census suppression policy, we will take that content down.
So you will, there is some threshold where you will fact check political advertisements. Is that what you're telling me?
Well, Congresswoman, yes, for specific things like that, where there's imminent risk of harm.
Would I be able to run advertisements on Facebook targeting Republicans in primary saying that they voted for the Green New Deal? I mean, if you're not fact-checking political advertisements, I'm just trying to understand the bounds here. What's fair game?
Congresswoman, I don't know the answer to that off the top of my head. I think
so probably, you don't know if I'll be able to do that.
I think
do you see a potential problem here with a complete lack of fact-checking on political advertisements?
Well, Congresswoman, I think lying is bad, and I think if you were to run an ad that had a lie, that would be bad.
So you won't take down lies, or you will take down lies? I think it's just a pretty simple yes or no. Okay.
I believe that people should be able to see for themselves what politicians that they may or may not vote for
are saying. So you won't take them down.
Judge their character for themselves.
So you won't take, you may flag that it's wrong, but you won't take it down.
That was just brutal.
I know.
I saw one person on Twitter being like, making the point that like, it's so funny because all of these like sad dudes are always like, AOC, debate me. And then you see something like this and it's like, do you really want that, babe?
Right. Right, I know.
Because it looks like she basically debated your weird leader.
Yeah.
And he looked like a complete fool. He got to the point where he was just like, I think lying is bad.
I know. It's like, so funny.
Okay.
And it like, the thing about his showing yesterday, though, that kind of is kind of scary is that I think he did better than he usually does.
He did better than the last one.
Yeah. It seems like they have settled on this theory that he either truly believes in or knows it's a thing that somebody could like realistically believe
something
in, which
a human
is,
might come up with as an opinion.
Exactly.
My calculations say someone might think this.
Yeah, he's been correctly programmed.
Yes.
And he is operating. He's functioning efficiently by saying this sort of thing that can sound really dignified if you actually believe it, which is like more speech is better speech. Like people have a right to know if they are being lied to. But and I think some of the other questioning got to this. It's like, yes, it's clearly voter suppression if you lie to people in an ad about where they're supposed to vote or when they're supposed to vote. But like, let's say there's like an ad for a candidate. Like, let's say our nominee is Joe Biden and people are like really mad about Joe Biden. And so then like turnout's going to be something everyone's really worried about. And then like his opponent, Trump or something, publishes a false ad with false information. Like you're going to depress turnout even more because people see that and they're going to be like, yeah, I don't even really love this guy. Like, I know people hate Trump, but like, it's going to be all about turnout in 2020. So that's voter suppression, too, if you're giving people information that could demotivate them from turning out.
Exactly. And we've just seen how this platform's loopholes have been manipulated in the past. So there are other ways that this could go that we don't even, like, we can't even conceive of all the ways like these trolls will use loopholes in Facebook's policy. Totally. I love the idea of going at like of everyone getting on board with what Elizabeth Warren did and Democrats just being like, if you're going to allow lies on Facebook, then we're going to like make some crazy ads and put them on your platform. Yeah. And like we're going to force your hand into doing something.
And that's the other crazy thing is that, you know, Dems like do not put as much into digital as Republicans do. Like Trump buys.
So dumb.
It's so annoying. It makes no sense.
Trump has spent millions of dollars on Facebook ads.
Apparently
already.
Joe Biden's campaign just like reallocated some of their funds to just go to TV ads. Yeah. It's like you have to play. The game is dirty now.
Yeah.
Like,
and the game is online. Yeah, this shit 100%. Is happening online. People are getting their news online. They are deciding who they're going to vote for online.
Right.
No one is watching your weird ads. No,
oh my God, yeah.
No one's watching them because even if there are people who watch cable TV, they fucking mute their TV during the ads, or they fast forward through a TiVo style, or they bought a package where they don't have to see ads at all. So it's like...
Right. I don't have like... I stream everything. I watch CNN streaming. I have Hulu without commercials. I have never seen a political ad on TV.
Sometimes when I watch like I'm watching The Bachelor.
Yes,
live,
there it is.
And I'm like, oh, commercials.
Right. Yeah.
Huh. Mm-hmm. What a world. Like it's like I don't ever see them. So you have, but I see online ads constantly.
Yeah.
And ads that people have released online, I am actually up to date with. Like when Bernie Sanders released that really good one recently, or some group supporting him released a good one recently, I saw it within an hour.
Yeah, because they go viral.
1 hour. Like yeah exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, it's bizarre. I just don't understand how, like, the logic that people deserve to know when they're being lied to by showing them the lie and not, like, I think there are some parts of the policy is to, like, you can put an ad up, but then, like, it might have a note, like, we're not sure if this is all true.
Yeah.
You could put that up a bit again, but honestly, like, and I think AOC said this, it's like, everything has spin.
Yeah, she was like, I'm not talking about spin. Yeah. I'm talking about false information.
That's why I think even allowing it up and putting like this might have false things, like you could say that about almost anything with a perspective if you wanted to, you know, if you really want, because like that's just how the game works.
And that's like, what I think
you,
is like, it's
going to represent things in your way.
It's going to start being put on every ad to the point where it doesn't mean anything. And yes, everyone's that's what I mean. Not going to be like, everyone's not going to be like, oh, wow, this ad is particularly false. They're going to be like, oh, well, all the ads have this on them. So they don't even care. Also, you know what else is newsworthy? The president putting up an ad and then Facebook taking it down.
Yeah.
The ad will, they'll still release it on YouTube or wherever. Exactly. People will then see the ad. He lied. And they'll like the whole story will become newsworthy.
Right.
So,
or, oh my God, they could have some fucking transparent process where they also tell us what ads were banned.
Yeah, like exactly. Just be like, they could be like, these, whatever, release a report. I don't know. So the whole thing is bullshit.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Yeah, which brings me, I guess, to my clip, which is also also from this hearing. One of our faves on the pod, Maxine Waters, also got an opportunity to grill Mark Zuckerberg. We, as you were saying, like, I mean, they were just tag teaming, dunking on him. It was amazing. It was really awesome. But Maxine, she kind of went into a similar line of questioning as AOC. We didn't include Zuckerberg's answer in the clip because he's literally like
just bumbling.
He's just like bumbling around. But Maxine's setup is pretty great. Yeah. So I wanted you all to hear it.
I now recognize myself for 5 minutes for questions. It is no secret that Facebook allowed Russia to undermine and divide our country through divisive online ads. The Senate's investigation discovered that African Americans were targeted the most by Russia, specifically in places where Black Lives Matter groups were the most active. Despite all of your technological expertise, Russia and Iran are at it again for the upcoming election. Then last week, you announced a new ad policy that gives politicians a license to lie so you can earn more money off this division, I suppose. Facebook changes the rules when it can benefit itself. Last year, Facebook banned all cryptocurrency ads on its platform because, and I quote, they are frequently associated with misleading or deceptive promotional practices, quote unquote. Seems fair. Then earlier this year, Facebook rolled back the cryptocurrency ad ban, bought a blockchain company, and announced its own cryptocurrency. So tell us what changed. How did cryptocurrency go from being misleading and deceptive last year and then becomes a means for financial inclusion this year?
Ouch.
Ouch. I love that.
Yeah. I mean, she got a lot in there.
Exactly.
Number one thing a lot of people were talking about was that the Russians did target the Black community disproportionately in their ads and used like inflammatory, like, Black Lives Matter rhetoric. Right. Like, they would like post things that were supposedly from Black Lives Matter that were like really like they would be like kill all cops or whatever, like post a meme that said that and then be like, look, Black Lives Matter posted this to like sow division. Right. So it's like the harm that was done to the Black community is even worse.
Right.
And then that point about like, so why are you doing cryptocurrency now?
I think that was so important. Like, I think that, you know, this was like technically to talk about Libra, but, and I'm going to quote, I read this in Axios, but the hearing covered Facebook's handling of discrimination and civil rights, its lack of diversity, its role in elections, free speech and content moderation, monopolistic behavior, anonymity, terrorism, and more. It's just like, not a good idea. Like, if you're, why don't you button all this up before you try to like get involved in the economy?
Yeah, like if you're going before Congress and terrorism is just one of many things you're being asked about, maybe it's time to pull back a little bit and like take a look.
He was also he was also asked, Rep Jennifer Wexton, a Democrat
from my
Virginia.
Hometown.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Love that. Well, she asked him if he was personally involved in Facebook's decision not to remove the video of Nancy Pelosi when like her speech was slowed down, right?
Oh yeah, it was like a doctored video that made it seem like it made her look like drunk.
It made her look drunk.
Of,
and so she asked, like, did you have anything to do with that decision? And he said yes. So Mark Zuckerberg was like, this can stay up.
Great.
And like, what's the rationale with that? So it's like, so you can know that Republicans would stoop to that level. Like, that's not what people think when they see it. It's too much to ask of people. Like, of course, I wish everybody were a little bit more news literate, but it's
deception. We know that they're not because now this big thing happened that proved to us that people are not good at sussing out where shit that they're seeing on Facebook comes from because Facebook makes everything look exactly
the
same. Like a news article from the New York Times shows up in your feed looking exact same as Uncle Grandpa's blog.
Exactly. Oh my God.
Okay, before we do main news, I have a personal plug, which I try to keep do rarely on the pod because I just want to give you guys the news of the day.
What's good for you is good for the pod.
So skip ahead 15 seconds if you don't want to hear anything about me or my personal life. But
it's still your professional life.
It is my professional life, actually. I am hosting a show. I've hosted this show for many years. It's called The Roast of Your 15-Year-Old Self. Comics come on. We show pictures of ourselves at 15, roast ourselves. I show all my old emo kid pics. And I want to let you guys know that we are doing the show at New York Comedy Festival, which is like a big deal. It's going to be at the Public Hotel, which is like very swanky.
Yeah.
It's November 5th at 7:30 p.m. We've got very funny comedians, in addition to myself, Mary Beth Barone, Jay Jordan, who just did a set on The Tonight Show, Alex English, who's part of the National Lampoon Radio Hour. National Lampoon is actually producing the show for us now, which is awesome. And we have friend of Betches, Derek Peth, of The Bachelorette, who's going to come on, and we're going to do a little interview about what he was like at 15, and we're going to show photos.
That'll be fun.
Which is going to be very cute, because I want to know, like, what kind of middle schooler becomes on The Bachelor later.
Yeah.
Like, was he cool then? We don't know. We're all going to find out on November 5th at 7:30 p.m. That's a Tuesday. It's at the Public. If you go on my Instagram, the link is in my bio.
Yep.
And that's at Pandalise, P-A-N-D-A-L-I-S-E on Instagram. And that's the end of my personal plug. Thank you.
We can put a link in the show notes too.
That would be so amazing.
Yeah, there's
going to
be mad links in our show notes.
Yes.
Today.
Yeah. Shall we talk?
Let's talk about Bill Taylor.
Bill Taylor.
We were talking about this morning. Elise was like, oh God, that was only 2 days ago.
I know. He's like I feel like every once in a while we get these random heroes of like the whole thing. And like now one of them is Bill Taylor.
I was so worried that he was going to disappoint. So Bill Taylor is the guy. I refer to these guys as like, who was he in the group chat?
Because
I feel like that's where we sort of got to know these personalities.
Yes.
He was the one who was like, I think it's crazy to withhold security assistance. He was the only one who was like, yo, what's going on? And then the sketchy guys would be like, call us.
Yes.
We'll talk about it on the phone. So now we sort of got the whole picture of like what happened on those phone calls. Bill Taylor was an ambassador to the Ukraine from 2006 to 2009. So I assume he left. He just didn't continue on with the Obama administration. And they asked him to sort of be the temporary ambassador again after they fired Maria Yovanovitch, who, you know, we know they did for sketchy reasons.
Yeah. And she's already testified.
She's already testified.
Well.
Yeah. My favorite part about, so he describes like being, he had a 15-page opening statement.
Yes.
That he read aloud. Apparently it took like 40 minutes and there were like gasps in the room.
Yeah, I know. I heard that like as he was reading, people were like, oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Like, when
in his statement, this was just funny to me. So he's like, yeah, they asked me to go back. And he was like, I consulted my wife and my friends and government. And he says, I will tell you that my wife, in no uncertain terms, strongly opposed the idea. So he drops that in. And I was like, maybe we'll come back to this.
Yeah.
Is there a reason for this? And
I wonder
he never
if she
comes
was like,
back to it. And
I feel like she was just like, don't fuck with Trump. Like, just don't even get involved with this guy.
For sure. I think it was just like, why was that worth mentioning? Like, he never followed up. It was his wife just like, tell them I told you
I bet that was it. I was like, she was like, you better put something in there.
I can just see her dictating in no uncertain terms, strongly opposed.
I love the idea of like the text messages breaking and her coming home and being like, well.
100%.
Look who was right again.
Right. Yeah, totally. But I was so glad because like when he was the guy in the text, I was like, oh, I want to stan him. I hope he does not disappoint. And he didn't disappoint.
No, people were saying that I saw a thing that was like, it's the most shocking impeachment testimony ever.
Yeah. I mean, I guess what was the most shocking thing about it?
I mean, he basically confirmed the quid pro quo.
All of them.
Yeah. He went into detail about...
He went into a lot of detail.
Yeah, about the multiple times he was told point blank that this aid to Ukraine was contingent upon specifically Zelensky opening an investigation into Biden and making an announcement about it. It was like very, very, according to Taylor, it was very important that Zelensky not only investigate, but also go public with the investigation.
Right. Yeah. So he describes like just another part of it that I thought was fun, that when he got to Ukraine. He said, but once I arrived in Kiev, I discovered a weird combination of encouraging, confusing, and ultimately alarming circumstances. I just like the use of weird.
Yeah.
Like, that sounds like something you put in. You're like, I'll go back. And he just didn't.
I love. Yeah, I do love that. Just being
it
like.
It was fucking weird, man.
Like you get to Ukraine vibes. And you're like ready to be in Ukraine. And then you're like, oh, shit.
These are weird vibes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, it's a really long statement. And he's sort of like. As I was reading, he's saying like, so I really like Bill Taylor.
Yeah.
He is clear. I think this also gave us the best picture of like what was at stake. Like everybody, not everybody else who testified, obviously, but like the only other testimony we've heard a lot of detail about, I think, mm-hmm. is Gordon Sondland.
Yeah.
Who's the ambassador to the EU and was involved with Ukraine policy, even though Ukraine is not in the EU. And he just he seemed discompassionate. He was like, Ukraine seems cool. They're doing what they're supposed to do. But Bill Taylor was like, he really cares deeply.
Yeah,
about Bill Taylor Ukraine's
took
future.
This job because he wanted to be the ambassador to Ukraine, not like Gordon Sondland, right. who's just like, I gave a bunch of money to Trump and now I have this job.
Yeah.
That doesn't even actually concern Ukraine.
Yeah, he knows the context. He knows the degree of Russian aggression. Like,
yes.
He painted a really good picture of like why it's so why withholding the aid or even suggesting that we might is so bad because it's not just about what it tells the Ukrainians, it's about what it tells the Russians.
Yeah.
Which is that like, we're hands off, you do what you want. Like they are actively at war. Like Bill Taylor described when he like had to make a visit there and he wasn't sure what was going on yet. And he remembers like the aid still wasn't released and he was trying to figure out why. And he was talking to a commander in the Ukraine who was like, basically was like, thank you so much. We need the U.S.'s help. Like, thank God you still give it to us. And he says, I was aware that this assistance was on hold, which made me uncomfortable.
Yeah. It's also, I think a point that gets kind of lost in a lot of this is that it's not for the White House to not release the aid.
Absolutely.
Like, if Congress allocated this aid. It was passed through Congress. That's one of Congress's specific duties in the Constitution. It's not actually up to the White House to hold it up or
not give
it. It
is illegal to not
let it go. Yeah, so it's like, I mean, there are so many layers of, like, and with everything with Trump, there are so many layers of criminality, corruption, things that aren't supposed to happen. But, like, even on a basic level, it's not, they're not allowed to withhold aid that has been passed by Congress.
Right, right. That's like, I've been thinking about this too, where whenever somebody doesn't cooperate with the impeachment, it's illegal not it's not a matter of I just don't feel like talking to you. And that's how it's covered. Like, well, she's not going to go. It's like, no, today, like they broke the law today by not going. And granted, a lot of people have defied White House orders not to go.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, thank God for the people who are testifying, though they've been told they're not supposed to testify. Yeah. Like, I think we're finally getting to a point where people are whistleblowing and standing up and being like, enough is fucking enough. Totally.
Right, right. Yeah. And Bill Taylor describes, like, his statement really tells a story. He sort of describes, like, starting to suspect that he was like, why aren't we doing a White House meeting? Like, Zelensky really wanted a White House meeting. He took a lot of steps to sort of show that they were rooting out corruption.
Mm-hmm.
So, Taylor was like, they really should have a meeting. They've earned it. Like, it doesn't look good that we're not, like, why aren't we doing this? And then over time, he starts to realize that it might be tied to something. And then Sondland tells him, like, yeah, the assistant is tied. This military assistance is also tied to that.
Yes.
So he says, like, eventually it became, you know, clear to him that there was 100% a quid pro quo because Gordon Sondland told him, even though Sondland said in his testimony that he didn't.
Yeah, Taylor said that Ambassador Sondland told him that, and this is a direct quote, everything.
Yeah.
Like, was dependent on the announcement and the security insistence.
Yeah.
Which is, like, a quid pro quo.
Yeah. Sondland told Taylor that Trump told him.
It's like, wait, okay, how did this go?
That he wanted to put Zelensky in a public box. So it literally boxed him in so that he had to make a statement. And if you make a statement about something, you have to do it. So presumably frame it as something that benefits your own people. And this part is super shocking. So, like, I guess I think this what I just said was the phone call that I think they were referring to in those texts when Bill Taylor was like, I think this is crazy. And Sondland said, call me. We now know what happened in that call where Sondland said, yeah, everything seems to be dependent on this, not just a White House meeting. And sort of trying to justify. So Sondland tries to justify this sort of exchange and this quid pro quo and tries to say, you know, that Trump's a businessman. So he says, this is probably Bill Taylor paraphrasing. When a businessman is about to sign a check to someone who owes him something, the businessman asks that person to pay up before signing the check. Ambassador Volker used the same term several days later. So apparently this was language that was coming from probably Trump to a lot of people.
It sounds like Trump.
It was a talking point.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. Which he thought was crazy because it's crazy anyway, but the Ukrainians don't owe him anything.
Yeah, like this isn't a business. It's a country.
Right.
And what we're finding is that trying to run a country like a business, especially when someone who has actually driven several businesses into the ground is the one who's in charge, is not working out in the best interest of everyone.
Right, right. So, I mean, these are just like the most explicit. I think throughout the statement, too, there was just like real connections between Trump himself.
Yeah.
Because before it just seemed like Zonlin was doing all of this. But apparently, like, Taylor was trying to figure out what was going on with the aid. And he was like talking to like the head of the CIA and the head of the all the heads of national security and all of these people with Mike Pompeo to try to get a meeting with Trump to be like, everyone thinks this aid should go through. Like, what is the problem?
Yeah. I mean, it was a really damning testimony for Trump, and it was so bad for Giuliani too.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Rudy might go down.
I think so. I think that's why he's not talking anymore, because I think he finally has a lawyer that's like, you can't keep doing this.
A lawyer other than his own self talking to himself in the mirror, being like, go on TV, Rudy.
I know. I saw something yesterday, just this story that was like, Trump lawyer says Trump could shoot somebody on the street and not be prosecuted. Yeah. And I was like, is Rudy back? But it seemed like it'd be
a different lawyer. Surprisingly. Yeah. Where is he finding these lawyers?
I know.
Trump University.
I was like, wait, is Michael Cohen out of jail? Yeah.
Yeah. Rudy is in a really bad place. Really bad place.
Yeah.
I do think we're going to get the Rudy testimony, which we've talked about. I truly cannot.
I think Rudy's going to prison.
Yeah.
Yeah. For
because
sure.
Because as anyone who's watched Succession will know, sometimes you got to offer up somebody big to try to save the real people. And I think
a blood sacrifice
will definitely throw a couple people on the fire before he allows shit to get
you
to
know
himself.
What's funny? I bet that like if Trump, I wonder if Trump watches Succession. He probably can't follow it.
No, I don't. I don't think he could.
But I hope he doesn't, because he'll watch and then he'll be like, Jared, it's got to be you.
Yeah.
Or like one of his sons. Like, yes. He's like, my sons are too stupid.
But, oh, well, yeah, his sons are too stupid.
They're even stupider than Kendall.
Yeah. Kendall. Well, OK, we won't get into it. But either way, I could see anyone pulling a Kendall from this administration as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Being totally. Like, I have.
Oh, yeah. Totally. Yeah. But like, moral of the story, this was for sure the most damning testimony yet. It had direct links. It was very detailed. It painted like a really damning picture of somebody who really, really just cared about only good things happening. You know, he described like, you know, 13,000 Ukrainians have died as part of this war. And he was like, more people will die if we don't help them. And I think that some of this can get really wonky, and like it's hard for people to understand it's clearly a violation of law and it's an impeachable offense, but like the practical, because I think there are a lot of things about how we treat, or there used to be like norms that felt like, I mean, these people are held to an incredibly high standard.
Yes.
And you know, sometimes things can sound like little things, or it's hard to maybe grasp the impact, but I think he painted a good picture of like what even suggesting that we might withhold aid would do to the geopolitical landscape, to say nothing of like actively withholding it to force their hand.
Yeah. I mean, it's just a really damning testimony.
Yeah, he confirmed like, we could talk more about it, but he confirmed all of the other most damning stuff before this. You
and
know?
Like, it kind of obliterated all the talking points about, like, I don't know. I mean, well, first of all, Mick Mulvaney tried to be like, there was a quid pro quo.
Yeah.
But there's always quid pro quos in like international relations. And it's like, I mean, in the sense that for the benefit of the country, not for the personal benefit of the leader.
Exactly. Right. Like, the quid pro quo has to benefit the United States.
Yeah.
Not
like,
Trump.
Yeah. Like, what does U.S. national security have to do with the fucking Bidens?
I think that Taylor described like inquiring who specifically had requested that they hold up the money. And it was Mick Mulvaney.
Well, Mick Mulvaney's also about
to
go down.
That's probably why
he
knew so much about it.
Yeah. I mean, he fucked up really bad. And now he's going to go down as well. But we won't rest until we get the last one.
Yeah. Right.
the big boss.
Yeah. So this testimony was so bad.
Yes. I was about to say, should we talk about how some Republicans in the House have responded to the most damning impeachment testimony in U.S. history?
With a tantrum.
They had a tantrum. So yesterday, two dozen Republicans led by Florida Representative Matt Gaetz.
I think it's Gaetz.
truly leaning into being a Florida man.
100%.
They stormed a secure closed door hearing as a protest. Basically, they think that, or they say that Adam Schiff has been lacking transparency.
They call it a Schiff show.
Yes.
Which, how cute. I mean, it is.
Yeah.
He's it handling is, it.
It's his show.
Yeah.
So they say that they've been too secretive. So they stormed into this meeting in this room that's called like an SCIF.
Yeah,
which
it's
is
called
just,
the SCIF.
Yes, the SCIF,
Sensitive,
which is just
Compartmented Information Facility, yeah. Which is very hard to keep. To not write SCIF when you want to write SCIF.
It's the SCIF. They stormed SCIF SCIF. Yeah. And and basically it's like any room where like classified information is happening. So
you
they
can't have phones.
They interrupted a Pentagon official doing a meeting in this SCIF. They brought their phones and some of them were recording during it. So they like violated
national
security protocol to kind of just put on a big show. You can see a picture. It's like 20 dudes led by Matt Gaetz, who's just being like, you got to let us in.
Yeah. What's funny is that they were like, so they all tweeted, and then the biggest response on Twitter was like, you can't have your phone in there. Like, you can only have secure phones, and if anyone brings their phone, then the police have to do, like, a sweep, because theoretically, you're talking about classified information in this room. That's why it's so secure.
Yeah.
So if anyone brings their phone,
testifying.
Right. If anyone brings their phone, they have to then do a sweep and make sure nobody left a phone, left a recording device. They had to do that. And then, so then a lot of these members started, they had tweeted, like, we're in the SCIF. We're stopping this SCIF show. And then I was like, yo, you can't do that. And then they all started adding like addendums to their tweets, like replying and saying like tweet from staff.
Yeah.
But it's like, how did you send your tweet to your staff?
Yeah. And like
they were like tweeted from Android.
Yeah. It's like, I don't know.
And they
know.
Keep trying to explain. They're like, well, one guy had a secure phone, but you can only text or call secure phones. If you have you can only call another secure phone. So like they 100% did it. And I was looking into like, can they actually like face repercussions?
Mm-hmm.
And apparently because they are legislators, like technically they were like, they thought that they were carrying out like legislative duties. Like mm-hmm. there are criminal statutes for this, but under the speech and debate clause of the US Constitution, they can't be criminally prosecuted. I read this on like a security blog.
Yeah.
But the Office of Congressional Ethics could investigate it. And it sounds like they really should, especially because Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy knew they were going to do it and supported it. The president supported it.
Yeah.
This came after the president literally said, Republicans have to get tougher. And then they did this.
So they just kind of like, it was just like a really weird public tantrum that resulted in nothing. And also
that compromised
like
national security.
Republicans have previously held closed door meetings like this during Benghazi and all of that. Whenever Clinton. They've needed them, they've used them. SCIFs exist because there's like, that's a thing that they need. There are also Republicans on that committee
that's
who are in the
thing.
Meeting.
Right.
So what Matt Gaetz is really mad about is that he's not allowed to go to meetings for committees he's not on that require security clearances and shit.
He's just mad the president's being impeached. Like there's no, this is what they want to do is focus on process instead of content. Like it's no coincidence this happened after like the worst testimony we've heard. And then what was the biggest news story yesterday that they had stormed? Not that we weren't talking about Bill Taylor anymore.
And Trump's talking point in the White House is like, they seem to be coalescing. I mean, they've had a really hard time figuring out what the fuck to say about any of this, but they seem to at least be coalescing around this idea that Trump is not getting due process and that the impeachment inquiry, the process behind it is corrupt and Nancy Pelosi is doing something shady and it's all shady and it's happening and like no one's doing the right process, which is not true. But that seems to be their play at the moment.
Yeah, they're still saying like you have to take a vote or it's not legitimate. That's not true. One representative called it a Soviet style process, which made me laugh. It's like, really? Like there is, of course they're in private. The House, like there's, you can't say there's nothing political about, like they're the political party in power. Of course they are going to do, like, and also like, this is just how it works. Like if Republicans do this to a president, they're not going to open it up. And there are Republicans in the fucking room. They're hearing it. This isn't, I also think it probably wouldn't be appropriate if only Democrats were hearing this testimony.
Oh yeah. No, there are Republicans in the room. And
it's like,
also
like lots, I think it's 46 Republicans and 62 Democrats.
This is like the beginning. These are initial.
We're all going to hear it.
Yeah. Like we're all going to, anything that like needs to come out, we're all going to hear. Reports are going to be written. These are the initial testimonies behind closed doors while they are going through the motions of this inquiry.
It's also designed so that witnesses can't watch each other and then decide what they're going to say.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, there are reasons, there are myriad reasons why these things happen behind closed doors for a single committee.
Yeah.
That includes both Democrats and Republicans. So, like, it's just,
Right. And like you said, we will see all this. We will all hear from Bill Taylor. I think what they're doing now is sort of figuring out how to, like, paint a really brutal picture, and I hope they do a better job than they did with the Mueller testimony.
Yeah. They seem to be, I will say that they seem to have learned a lot of things, and things are being handled in this situation a lot better, I think, both by the Democrats and the media.
Yeah.
So, I mean, obviously things aren't perfect, but I do feel like I've seen lessons learned in a way that I have not, and the Republicans seem to be scrambling in a way that they have not been scrambling before.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there was Lindsey Graham, apparently, hearing what the Republican House members did, said, like, that wasn't a good idea.
Yeah.
He called it nuts. He called it nuts to run on the skiff and said they should not have gone about it that way.
Yeah, I mean, Matt Gaetz is just an idiot.
Yeah, it's funny to see the dynamic between the Senate and the House members. Like, I feel like you just get it's really like a big brother, little brother situation. Yes.
Well, the House Republicans are...
they're maniacs.
Luku.
Yeah, it's wild.
They're like much crazier than the Senate Republicans are. Like, I mean, it's like Ted Cruz and Lindsey Graham who have like, but they, who like, they're crazy, but they seem to know what they're, they have their wits about them politically. Yes. But like, these are people, these are like Matt Gaetz,
Jim Jordan,
these people who are just seem genuinely unhinged.
Yeah. Somebody wrote into the Instagram that Jim Jordan never wears a jacket, which is true.
That is true.
He's never wearing a jacket. I wonder why. Does he have like really long arms or really short arms? Does he just get very warm?
Interesting.
They're all always wearing jackets.
Why isn't he wearing a jacket? I'm like literally thinking back and I'm like,
hiding?
Every time I've ever seen Jim Jordan, he's in a button-down shirt.
And everybody else is usually wearing a coat.
What does it mean?
Yeah.
What does it mean?
I know. So more testimonies are coming.
Yes.
Yeah, I think we might start hearing like open door hearings in like mid-November. I want to see
Bill Taylor open door. I want Rudy it's open door fun. So bad.
I know.
That would be a beautiful Christmas gift from the House Democrats to the nation.
Totally. What's interesting though is if the president is impeached in the House and it goes into the Senate, it kind of sucks for all the senators running for president. Because they have to be there.
They do have to be there.
So that's even a consideration that the Senate is thinking about. Like, do we sort of limit how many days that we do this a week?
Yeah.
But, you know, they can't go. I mean, I want to see Kamala Harris.
Yeah.
Just ram
all of
them.
Well, Kamala has to show up.
Yeah.
I don't really care. The other ones, I mean, I'd love to see Liz do it, whatever. But Kamala needs to be in school that day.
Yes. 100%. Yeah. And one last like piece of breaking impeachment news that I saw this morning that I just thought was interesting that... apparently Zelensky, the new Ukrainian president, somebody who was in on a meeting with them was CNN source and said that they had been talking about this and they knew that this is what Trump wanted and they were trying to figure out what to do because they also like they knew it was nuts, but they were like, he's still the American president. What do we do about this? Like, and Bill Taylor said repeatedly in his testimony, like, Zelensky did not want to be a pawn in U.S. elections. Yeah. Like, he knew it was so clear. Like, even Zelensky knew that that's what Trump wanted.
I mean, this is it's also like it's just stereotypical bully behavior, which is like so classic Trump. It's like picking on somebody who's not your own size at all. This is a small country that's literally in a war with Ukraine. They can't go forward without U.S. aid. They can't stand up to us. They're not in a position where they can stand up to the United States without really severe consequences, like death level casualties incurred. So it's like, it's just, you see how Trump lets fucking Putin do whatever he wants.
Totally.
He lets all the like even like Kim Jong-un, he'll let do whatever he wants. But then when he sees someone he can push around, he's going to be like, he's going to do it to the Ukraine. And that's what happened here. Like, Zelensky's not, I don't really have like a bad opinion of Zelensky.
No.
I'm just like, what's he gonna fucking do?
Yeah.
The biggest, baddest kid on the playground just like pushed him down and was like, give me your lunch money.
Right.
You know?
Right. Yeah. And he was just like, can you hold on, please, until somebody in your country tells on you?
Exactly. And he's like, I'll give you your lunch money back if you say some shit.
Exactly. right. Totally. I'm not going to sign the check. Also, that analogy about the sign the check, it was like, does anyone actually do that? Just like you have the person in front of you, you're like, I will not sign. I have a check in front of me, but I will not sign it.
Yeah.
And it was just a very bizarre
analogy. Yeah, it's all strange.
Yeah.
Okay. Should we get on to one more thing?
Yeah.
This is interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess this was you guys talked about this on Monday. I think Sammy referenced it
briefly, but we wanted to make sure we talked about it.
So last week, Congress received a 9-page report from the State Department, which stated once and for all that Hillary's use of a personal email account was inappropriate, but ultimately not that big of a deal.
Yeah.
Like, she shouldn't have done that, but there weren't really any major consequences of any kind as a result of her doing it. And, like, going forward, we should definitely just all use the secure server.
Even though, basically, what was it, like, a couple weeks before the election when James Comey was like, we think there could be something up. This is basically them now saying there was nothing
up. When they raided Anthony Weiner's stupid fucking house.
Jesus Christ. Oh, my God. I forgot about that. Fucking Anthony Weiner is why Hillary Clinton isn't president. I think.
Anthony Weiner.
Wow.
I remember when he used to go on The Daily Show and I was like, he seems really cool. I think he'll be the mayor of New York.
And I love Huma.
I know. I hope that she's got her gal pals around her and then like did some work about like self-love and was like examined why she was dating Anthony Weiner and is now doing better.
Because
I do love Huma.
I know. Yeah. So, and I mean, it was just like in 2016, the New York Times did as many cover stories about HRC's emails as they did about all policy issues combined in the 69 days leading up to the election.
Yeah.
Many papers buried the news of this exoneration. We're a couple days late to it, too. Which, because like now we're in such a like shit show of news. It just didn't, you know, it sort of falls down. But when you consider how overinflated it was in 2016, and now we just know that the State Department was like, this was fine.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of goes back to what we were talking about like the reckoning in the media that had to take place after 2016. And it's like, what did we do and how can we do better? And I do feel like they are trying, at least when I see, like a lot of the coverage I see of the Joe Biden stuff does not give credence to the conspiracy theories at all. Whereas like the coverage of Hillary Clinton's email server really left it up to, like, they made it really seem like
that's
it was
very
this
true.
Horrible,
they were trying
bad
to do
thing.
Both sides. Whereas, like, now I just see every time they mention a conspiracy, or they say this is a conspiracy that has been debunked.
Yeah.
But we'll never forget her emails. That's why, so we made a beanie.
Yes.
We made a hat that says, but her emails, because it's funny, whenever I post something on Instagram story, that's just something crazy about what Trump's doing, a lot of you guys reply, but her emails. And I always feel that way too. And everybody, literally, we could have had a bad bitch.
Yeah,
but her emails, and so we wanted that to speak for us.
We could have had a bad bitch. But her emails. That's fun.
Amazing.
That's very fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you can buy that.
I love the beanie.
Betches.com.
And
we also have we also had a really popular sticker that said "Don't call your ex, call your senator," and we made that a phone case because that seemed fitting. So that's up there too.
And holidays are coming up, guys.
Yeah.
Get them for the politically savvy person in your life.
Put them on your wish list. We put it in a place where you can still use a pop socket if you like.
Beautiful. Yeah. I love that. All right. Well, guys, I think that brings us to the end of our episode.
Yeah.
Please remember to rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast. I mean, I assume you're subscribed if you're listening to it, but if you've just been like going back for some reason, not subscribing, checking on your own, maybe hit that subscribe button. Tell us what you like about the pod so we can do more of it. We've got some fun new segments in the works that we're going to be working on. Always, as always, sign up for the newsletter.
Yes. Do we have a newsletter announcement?
Yes. We're moving the newsletter back to noon.
Yes.
So we did a little experiment where we were like, would people like it later in the day? And the answer is no.
Yes. So thank you guys for giving us your feedback.
Yes. And
so
thank
now
you.
We know.
Thank you for sticking with us. We're going back to noon tomorrow. Yeah. So it'll be, you know, if you're not signed up, it'll come to you between like noon and one tomorrow.
Yes. Yeah. Awesome.
So you miss 100% of the shots you don't take, and we needed the data.
Yeah,
so
you gotta take risks. We got the data
and it was overwhelming.
Yeah.
All right, guys, until the end of democracy, I'm Elise Morales.
I'm Amanda Duberman.
And this is the Betches Sup Podcast.
Okay, guys, we're back. This is Amanda. I'm here today with Meredith Feinman. She is an entrepreneur, writer, and consigner. She is the author of a book coming out next year called Brag Better, Meredith, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
Yeah, of course.
The mothership.
So, yeah, awesome. Meredith and I were just talking. We are both avid memers, and it's a shared love.
To be recognized for my meme capability is making me feel deeply seen and understood.
I mean, is there higher praise in 2019?
I know. I actually, 1 year for my birthday, got like a sheet cake from a, and it said meme. I asked them to put meme queen on it, but they didn't get it. And so it said Mimi queen, cause they assumed that was like my name or something. Right. And they capitalized both M's and it was great.
Yeah. I've been thinking to myself that I'm trying to, you know, really beef up my dog's Instagram. And I think it just has to be a meme account. I've been trying to do like earnest, like look at me in my bow tie, but it's
I saw
not
your
really
weenie dog.
Off. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I would love to be a pet show mom for my dog Bean.
Yeah.
And she's an Instagram.
I love
and Bean. She wears outfits and it just seems like a lot of work. Like those show parents put a lot of effort.
It's
into
a lot.
That.
It's like a lot of work. I don't think it's a ton of reward.
No.
No.
But some of the original ones there were and now.
Right. I think that's why that's how you're good at it. You do it for the love of it, not for the income. But
thank
for
you.
Me, I'm just like, oh, I'd have to engage with every single person that's like engaging with my animal. It's too much work. But anyway, Meredith, can you just like, I want to start really general. Can you just like tell me who you are and what you do and why you do it?
Yes. So dear listeners, I'm Meredith Feinman and I run a company called Fine Point, which is a leadership and professional development company that helps those in power, CEOs, founders, deal with visibility and voice. I specialize in women in positions of power. I don't only work with women, but it came from my running my company as a public relations firm, and I started to realize a bunch of things, namely this extreme cult of personality that was happening in startup land and an individual being a driver of business more than ever before. And I didn't think it was fair that the benefits associated with understanding how to present yourself, press, media. I grew up in the media and politics bubble. And so I sort of inherently knew about that. I didn't think it was fair it be reserved for those for whom it came naturally, which is like three people. And then I discovered that nobody knew how to talk about themselves.
Yeah.
And that was a particular issue for women. I was watching the whole trajectory of this systemic issue. And I would have young women that want to work for me. And when I asked them about their accomplishments, they would have difficulty bragging about it. Mm-hmm. And same would happen with contemporaries and friends. I would have to hop in and play publicist. And then very, very high powered people, not only women, but I speak and train on women in bragging. That's my thing, though my audience has expanded beyond women into a demographic I call the qualified quiet, which are those that have done the work but don't know how to talk about it, which is not a weakness, it's a strength, it's 99% of us. And my book, Brag Better, on this subject is out next June with Portfolio at Penguin Random House. And I'm a longtime freelance writer, longtime memer, and my other deep passion is secondhand fashion and sustainable fashion.
Yeah. Awesome. Cool. So you've already sort of touched on this, and one of my biggest questions is somebody who definitely has a problem bragging. Sometimes I feel like I've only recently granted myself permission to like consider myself as like a qualified quiet. I feel like that's a step too. But you touched on this by saying, you know, it's not really fair that you know, people that can sort of play into this cult of personality are the most rewarded to it, but it doesn't come naturally. And I think maybe, I know for me, I didn't really realize later in life that it's something that you can develop. I think a lot of people think you either have it or you don't. So is it, do you think it's more about, you know, learning how to brag better? Is that more about, you know, becoming more comfortable with bragging or just pushing through and realizing it might never sort of be natural? How do you sort of approach this for people to whom it feels unnatural?
So a couple different things, like a million different things.
Yeah.
So one, you're so not alone in feeling that way. That's what I do for a living. I shifted my company to tackle this systemic issue. I also deeply want to acknowledge, I think a lot of books that are instructive on behaviors, put the onus on the reader. And I want to be very clear that this is a systemic issue.
Yes.
That women's voices are oppressed and suppressed all the time. And there is a system in which It makes it difficult to be a woman in public. And one reason why I focus on that is you're judged on metrics that men are not. Historically, positive attributes were associated with passive behaviors. And I always make it clear to people that you shouldn't know how to do these things. You don't have role models. For women, you know, you have all the societal patriarchal factors. And you also don't have a vocabulary to do this. So as a writer, that's what Brag Better is. And I always make clear that what I do is not rocket science. Mm-hmm. Anyone can learn this. That's the point of the book. And you've actually done the most difficult part, which is putting in the time and energy and the work. Right. This is gravy. This is a skill set I've taught myself and at this point hundreds, if not thousands of other people. It's something you can 100% learn. And yes, it's always evolving. It's something that I think, you know, it's tied to a lot of other concepts that we talk about and read about, like imposter syndrome and things just make us feel sort of not worthy of sharing what we've done. So it's just such a universal problem that's why I've chosen to tackle it. So I would say, you know, on your part, like, I'm not surprised you have trouble with it. Yeah. Like, do I have a book for you? You know, and that's what I consult on and represent people on all day, every day. So I have that conversation constantly. And in the thousands and thousands of people I've spoken to about bragging, about Brag Better, I purposely choose brag. Mm-hmm. It's a controversial word.
Yeah, I wanted to
ask
you about that too. Is that sort of an attempt to kind of like reclaim the word?
It is. Yeah. It is. And it's in your face. And yes.
It also kind of, I think that, I was going to say as women especially, but I think I know personally that I can sometimes have trouble advocating myself because it feels like bragging. But if you say bragging itself is fine, it's not a problem. You can call it bragging. I feel like that makes it more accessible to me. Like, okay, that is what it is. It's okay. That's what this process, like, it's a necessary thing.
100%. And it is, as I said, it's evolving. But one reason why I also chose brag was we don't have that many other words.
Right.
So the definition of brag is to talk about oneself boastfully, which gives you nothing.
Right.
If you look into boastful, it's to talk about oneself with excessive pride. So that is entirely subjective.
Yeah.
And, you know, in writing this book and looking into some of the history and the language, one reason why I cared about creating this was that there just is a very limited number of words we can use for some of these activities. And they're incredibly necessary. You know, a lot of this is for professional confidence, but a lot of it is you're leaving money on the table if you're not bragging, whether it is an internship, whether it is a raise, whether it is a corporate board seat. It looks different for everyone. It's just very necessary.
That's so interesting. Yeah. So you said that you sort of did a lot of research before this book, and I assume you read a lot of history and social science. Was there anything that you had expertise in this before you started to write a book about it? Was there anything you came across that really sort of surprised you about like the historical context and the social science for doing this?
So I have been training people for almost a decade and working with the word brag explicitly, I would say, since about 2013. So I had a whole host of people that I've worked with to, you know, pull from. And then there's very limited research and understanding, you know, and looking in the actual language of it and the origins of the word is a little bit sticky and complex. I think that I'm trying to think if there's anything that particularly surprised me because, well, there's lots of different research about all the different facets of this. And I sort of think that you could either live and die by a small sample size or, you know, you could think about some of these things. And listen, I've been called every name in the book. Like when you are someone who decides to be vocal and put yourself out there, I mean, it's an act it's an act of vulnerability. That's what it is. That's why it's hard.
Yeah.
And it, again, you don't have a framework for doing it.
Totally. We love Brené Brown in this family.
Yes. And I would say what I'm very, very proud of with the book was the range of people that I interviewed for it. For me, I cared that Brag Better also as a, you know, white, straight, cis woman that so much of Brag Better is about passing the mic to other people and using your privilege. If you are a voice we listen to, if you are a man, if you are a white person, helping amplify the voices of others. So the people I interviewed are wildly diverse in terms of, you know, age, race, gender, perspective, ability. And so I think that that was the best and most surprising part, was also that everyone has their own spin on it too.
Cool. And I feel like a couple years ago, around sort of like the big days of Lean In, there was like a lot of social science coming out, sort of implying that like women who, I don't know if it was sort of speak up or advocate for themselves specifically, but implying that like women who really do actually do lean in, women who speak up, who advocate for themselves, aren't always seen favorably. And I could expect that that also applies to other sort of minority or marginalized groups. Do you think that's still true? And if so, like, what advice is that sort of addressed in the book? How?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, look at that meeting, that photo came out of Nancy Pelosi standing up and talking to Donald Trump. And I think his tweet was like, look at this woman having a meltdown.
Yeah. Right.
Yep. Just like literally happened.
Yeah.
Yesterday or today. And I saw that circulating, and that is, you know, there's so much to be said about gender and women and women that choose to speak up. Some of the studies I think are helpful in understanding, like, yes, it's helpful if you're a woman and you have a man literally echo your sentiments and echo your voice. Like, if you say something in a meeting and you ask a male colleague, I talked to Jessica Bennett, who wrote a Feminist Fight Club, about, she has this idea of a boss bitch, which is someone that helps you brag better, essentially. And if it's a man, like, the science behind your words being actually heard, if a man echoes your sentiments, are real.
Wow.
This is also true, though. I mean, one thing you can do right now is just echo the sentiments of someone that needs to be heard. I mean, just the more voices that are saying the same thing, repetition, human beings like remember things by repetition. So there's a lot of sort of competing research. I tried in my book, I will say it's a lot of anecdotal work that I have found over the past decade. But there was one study in particular called, I think it's the self-promotion gap, that was done by Amanda Hirsch, who I interviewed. She runs something called Mighty Forces. And that was about how basically 7 out of 10 women that she had in her study would rather insult their accomplishments than promote them. I'm botching that a little bit. I'm paraphrasing. But a lot of those sorts of things are true. And, you know, we'd rather downplay our achievements and our accomplishments. And I think that, you know, I've said it's important for business. It's important for how you feel. But going into 2020 and, you know, circling back to a lot of topics you talk about on this podcast, I think that, you know, I'm sorry it's hard for you to talk about what you've done, but we need to be listening to the voices that have done the work. So much of Brag Better stems from my seeing this inverse relationship between volume and merit, that we just reward loud.
Yeah.
And as much as I would like to think we can get loud voices to be quiet, I do not believe that that's possible. Yeah. I think we got to get the quiet people to be louder. Now, I don't mean screaming. I mean that it's just strategically loud.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you have a chapter in your book that has sort of that phrasing. Can you kind of elaborate more on how you look at that?
Yeah. So it's one of the chapters in the book is called Loud, Proud, and Strategic, which are sort of like the three pillars of how I think about someone's message. And, you know, brag is supposed to be somewhat subversive.
Yeah.
You know, you can yell if you want. You can throw yourself a parade if you want. You can use any extreme example. I'd be thrilled.
Yeah.
You know, people come to me like, well, what if I brag too much? I'm like, well, that level of self-awareness usually means that, you know, that's the difference between someone who, you know, just bloviates on television is like they don't have that internal monologue that's like, wait, like, am I qualified enough?
Yeah.
So, you know, thinking about that. But the idea is to be loud, however that means to you. And another amazing person I spoke to for the book is Susan Cain, who wrote Quiet, about the power of introversion and finding a medium that works for you. So whether that's podcasts, whether that's writing, whether that is just telling one person. I mean, a lot of this is about smaller actions. And then the pride factor, I talk a lot about pride being important and gratitude being important. And that takes time. Yeah. Tell people that bragging, it's facts. It's facts about things you've done, and you're stating those facts, and you're stating those facts to propel yourself and propel those around you, because Brag Better is so much about you know, promoting others and share, you know, Shine Theory and everyone, there being space on the stage for everyone. And then the strategic piece is using that to get your message through, not all the time, but in ways that get you heard and get you what you want. And that's the strategic piece.
Yeah. Awesome. So I'm sure you sort of have, it's interesting that you're talking about, I feel like with social media, we've actually had the opportunity to amplify voices who are doing this and actually be celebrated. Like, I feel like Serena Williams is a good example. And even this week, like, Simone Biles said, like, I literally am the best. Like, it's written in history. I am the best. And now we have the power, like, that is rewarded on social media. And then it sort of, I feel like it becomes even more indisputable just because it's taken far and wide and you can actually signal boost these things in like a meaningful way now, but it still does take one person to sort of make the statement.
100%. And when, you know, Megan Rapinoe said, you know, I deserve this. I mean, you deserve this. You've done the work. I think that talking about your work. So the issue is that, you know, if great work falls in the woods and nobody hears about it, like, is it going to get you where you want to bungle like a million different phrases? But, you know, people don't know what you've done until you tell them.
Totally.
And I think, yes, on social, you know, it's obviously a double-edged sword. I love it for the meme capability and the humor and seeing and discovering interesting people, interesting women. And it taking people's careers farther than before and, you know, getting some of that attention and running with it. And seeing some of that spread, I think is a really great thing to see. And it remains to be seen, you know, what platforms exactly, like, I want to be really careful with this book that I didn't go too specifically into each platform. Cause you know, things are constantly evolving, but you know, I tell people to pick one platform and do it well. If you want to share and yes, with those sorts of things, it has taken people's messages farther than ever before.
Yeah. Did bragging come naturally to you before you sort of decided to orient your career around doing it and helping people do it?
Yeah. So I think to some degree I've always been kind of loud, but I was pretty shy as a young kid. And I grew up in, as I said, the media and politics bubble of Washington. I have a talking head dad, and I understood from a very young age what it meant to be in public. And I think that my watching that and then understanding how to apply it to myself, which I sort of, you know, a lot of this is faking it till you make it, like, and just really you have to push yourself. And I started doing that from a really young age and got used to sharing my opinions and asking questions. Doesn't always, you know, win you a lot of friends, I will be quite honest. But I think that it was pretty young for me, and then I was able to turn my learnings and some of that into what I can help other people do.
Yeah. Did you start to notice when you sort of entered working and stuff that it was something that, I guess, when you, did you know that you were maybe a little bit more comfortable with voicing your opinion when you were younger, and then you sort of started being in work environments and started noticing that you were kind of, not everybody felt the same way or was as motivated to do it? Or did you?
Yeah. So, well, to be quite honest, I lasted about 5 months working for someone else before starting my own company. Yeah. So I have somewhat of an authority problem. I am not a passive person. Yeah. And so, I think seeing some of that, at first maybe began as just not understanding it and then being like, oh, like I can help you with this, but it's also never about like not being who you are or trying to be a different version of yourself. You know, like that I always want to be clear about that is like, I want everyone to be true to their unique, this is annoyingly businessy, but unique value proposition. Like, you know, everybody's got their own thing going on. And a huge part of Brag Better is like, you don't, this is not like, oh, I won a Nobel Prize. It's like, oh no, like I had this win today at the office, or I'm really great at managing people. Or, you know, I feel like I really killed this project. Like, thank you. And I want you to look at it. Also, like, this person did a great job, too.
Yeah. I mean, what's so appealing to me about the concept of Brag Better is that it's acknowledging that, like, even if it doesn't come naturally to you, it can. It's a skill. It's something you develop. I think you just assume if you see, because now there is more visibility, especially of women being able to sort of embrace
this type of attitude towards things. I know it's amazing to see, but I know personally sometimes I'm like, God, I don't think I could ever be like that. And I think it like takes, I think the, it didn't even occur to me for a while that it was something that you could sort of learn. And I feel like since I've been trying to like, cause I went through changing jobs, and I think that a lot of us don't even really learn to identify our accomplishments until we have to, like we're not, so until we have to brag maybe. So I noticed that like when I was in a position where I had to advocate for it, that was the point of why I was somewhere. I like had a more generous eye towards my own accomplishments, and I was able to sort of identify them. So I feel like just like pushing yourself to use that muscle can also just like give you a better sense of like what you're actually, what you've actually done. I feel like a lot of us just sort of like chug along day to day, and it takes sort of like forcing yourself to reflect to really actually see the things that you have that have value.
Absolutely. Anyone can learn how to do this.
I guess I'm saying is there seems to be like a big mental health intersection.
Yes. Here. Yeah. Yeah. So a lot of this, like the first part of it is like everybody that seems like they've got it figured out is just like lying.
Yeah.
I mean, that is the flip side of social media is like, you know, you're literally, I think Cindy Gallup says this, comparing your behind the scenes to someone else's highlight reel.
Yeah. Wow.
Like literally, yeah, totally. Put a filter on, you know, make it pretty, whatever your life you're doing. It's fake. It's fake. It's not real. And so I think that this also isn't about necessarily being fake, but
yeah,
acknowledging, you know, there are opportunities all around you to promote yourself, and it's taking advantage of those. But also anyone that you see that you would say like, oh, they are doing this so well, was probably trained to do that. And it's not, because even if they had a kernel of that in them, it had to be refined to be palatable to media. Like it had, you know, so the truth is it's a skill set. I mean, I'm also a media trainer and a PR person. Cool. Like this stems from the work of publicists, which was that this idea, the packaging, the pitching, the like creating this campaign of you is applicable to yourself and to anyone at regardless of position, like level of work. I have the same conversation that I do with, you know, high school or college kids that I do with very, very senior executives.
Yeah. Awesome. So I think as we've been talking about this, and I think how a lot of people sort of conceive of self-promotion and advocating for themselves, we're talking about it to do so to sort of like promote our own interests or benefit professionally. But how does getting better at sort of bragging or selling yourself or advocating for yourself or a situation you believe in, you know, how does that like improve the world around us too, in terms of whether it's social justice or political environment? I mean, does this apply to sort of just us, or how does it affect, how does having this ability sort of more positively affect everything about your life?
Totally. I mean, a huge, huge undisputable part of bragging better is doing so for others, is learning to refine how to hype your friends, how to hype your colleagues, how to, you know, promote issues you care about. There is enough space on the stage, and your privilege or your visibility is endless with this. You're not losing something by helping someone gain something else. And so it's not a loss on your part to help some boost someone else. Not only does it feel really good, but it's something that when people have done it for me and they didn't have to, it's just an incredible act of generosity. And I believe in paying it forward. As I said, if you are a voice that someone listens to in, you know, the science backing a man, if you're a man listening to That Just Sup podcast, it is part of your job to echo women's voices and promote women and their voices and ask them how, you know, you can help them, not just women, you know, other subgroups and demographics and people that we don't listen to as much. But yeah, that's when it gets really fun.
Yeah.
Is realizing that, you know, there's tons of opportunity to promote yourself, but sometimes it feels really awesome to help promote other people too.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause I guess as you're sort of sharpening your eye for how to look at your own kind of like portfolio of strengths and weaknesses, mostly strengths, you're sort of, that applies to how you see other people too, and you're able to sort of identify things in them that maybe they haven't sort of seen as things that they can hype up too.
100%. And I think that also we just have a responsibility for the voices in our media, in our leadership, to reflect like what humans really look like and what humans really sound like.
Yeah.
So, you know, diversifying that is crucial, because that's what, you know, we want our corporate boards and we want our leadership, whether that's in government or in other places, to reflect like what we look like as a people. And right now that's, you know, super white and male. Yeah. So that's important. Not only that this idea that the, you know, a rising tide lifts all boats, yes. but also that those in power, brag better for others too, and recognize that yeah. since people listen to them, they have an obligation to pass that microphone to other people too.
Yeah. Awesome. We sort of covered this a little bit, but who are some famous women or public figures who, in your view, are really good at bragging?
So when I often ask people when I'm consulting or coaching them one-on-one about voices they admire, there's so many different voices I admire for different reasons. Like, I trend really towards humor mm-hmm. and comedians. So, you know, like an Ali Wong right yeah. now, whose book just came out, which I can't wait to read.
Yeah.
Or Chrissy Teigen, who has like figured out every internet algorithm yeah. on the planet. I don't even know how. Like yeah. she is like one of those very, very rare examples of it just like she just, it's just,
yeah.
like you can't train that.
No.
I agree. So I'd say that. I mean, I think Elizabeth Warren's doing a great job of being like, hi, I have all of these ideas yeah. and plans and yeah. I've done this work and I'm going to, you know, charge $6.95 an hour for my consulting services back in the day, and which I think is actually very low.
Yeah, yeah.
Like I was triple
yeah.
that.
Yeah, I mean, we even saw in the debate, literally, as Elizabeth Warren is explaining her unquestionable achievement, the thing that she built, and then the dude next to her was like, well, I kind of helped a little bit.
Yeah.
Was like, and she was, I found it like a very inspiring response she had, that she was just sort of like,
well, and I think that the 2016 election, it's yeah. funny, like I've been fighting for these concepts for a long time and for Brag Better for a long time. And I did it a little bit too early in mm-hmm. that it was pre-Trump, pre-2016 election, pre-Me Too,
yeah.
all these different things when, you know, women were sharing their voices more than ever. But, you know, that election was just the most literal representation of, you know, our inverse relationship between volume and merit.
Yeah.
Now it's way, way, way more complicated than that. But after that election, I was like, oh shit, I got to keep doing this.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Awesome.
Can I swear on this?
Yes, page? Definitely. Okay. Of course. Awesome. So I want to sort of shift gears. You also, are very into secondhand shopping, which is super cool. I feel like you've sort of taught me a lot about it through your Instagram, and you have a podcast called It Never Gets Old. I'm really curious how you sort of got into this and how this became a part of your life.
Yeah, so I love clothing that belongs to someone else yeah. first. Yes, and It Never Gets Old has been really fun. Please look it up wherever you get your podcasts. So I started secondhand shopping when I was 11. Wow. I'm 32. My mom loved thrift shopping and secondhand shopping, and she took me one time to get something, I don't remember what, and this is, I feel like, very like Betches adjacent, is that I saw this green tank top poking out of like a row of stuff, and it was CNC California, and yeah. I was like, holy shit. And it was you know, if you're a, you know, millennial yeah. woman growing up in the aughts, like CNC California yeah. was like the thing, and you'd wear the two like layered
right.
and it yeah. was I think like $8 yeah. and I was like, oh, this is mismarked, but yeah. I really like it. And I brought it to saleswoman, and she was like, no. I was like, is this marked wrong? And yeah. She's like, it's consignment. And I was like, yeah. well, what's consignment? She's like, well, someone else had it first. And I was like, cool. I just like took totally. The tag off, and I yeah, think yeah. I put it on. I definitely didn't wash it. and ever since then, I got super hooked in yeah. that I really care about fashion, and I always wanted to have the latest and greatest and have unique things that other people didn't. And I loved the hunt. And in sort of the 20 years since, I have just voraciously bought secondhand IRL online, yeah. though I prefer stores, and I, you know, traverse the planet, and in every city I go to, it's like my main yeah. blood sport, and it's been really fun finally educating people on it.
What percent of your wardrobe is secondhand, do you think?
I would say like 80 to 90%.
Wild. That's amazing.
89, cool. And you can get anything secondhand.
Yeah.
I mean, I want to wear all designer stuff. All my stuff is designer, yeah. and it's all it's much, much more affordable. But then by you know, way of secondhand fashion, I got into sustainable fashion.
Yeah. yeah.
Because buying secondhand is the most sustainable option, and you have a million apps now, and you have the success of, you know, I was just coming from the Real Real store in Soho, cool. and I'm always like checking things out.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
you know, you have the Depop, which the youths love, mm-hmm. And all these different sites. And I think it's just something that's really fun,
yeah,
and really good for the planet. And I finally wanted to teach people about it and get serious about it. And I consult on the whole landscape of the industry. It's a multi-billion dollar industry.
Wow. Yeah. Have you sort of noticed more of an appetite for more information about shopping secondhand in the past couple of years since kind of the role of fast fashion and how it is like the worst thing out there?
Yeah, I mean, 100%. That today we have new episodes on Thursdays. I'm not sure when you'll be hearing this in your ears, but our most recent episode is Fast Fashion Dead and What is Slow Fashion?
Yeah.
You know, with Forever 21 filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, and the next generation, honestly, like Gen Z, they care most about climate,
yes,
and thrifting and secondhand and reduction of waste, and conscious labor consumption, and, you know, water that is used to create things. They're all super conscious about it. So that's super duper cool. And I think with, you know, the Real IPOing, I mean, this is a major thing that the fashion industry is having to contend with.
Totally. Yeah. What would you tell somebody who has relied pretty heavily on either fast fashion, or I feel like I'm sort of at this stage where I don't do fast fashion anymore, but I do a lot of like Everlane and I love Everlane, and I like try to make sure I'm buying, but I also am very conscious of like the stuff. I know that the stuff that I need already exists in the world. So I'm trying to transition more from buying things that, you know, I'm trying not to contribute to too much demand. What would you tell somebody who's like first sort of getting started and wanting to sort of shop more secondhand?
Totally. So It Never Gets Old is some news about the industry, some specific topics like how to find secondhand Gucci, but a lot of it is like very much 101, because I have been buying and selling my wardrobe and made money on my wardrobe consistently for 2 decades. And so you can also make money in this in addition to saving money. So I would say start somewhere that is a little bit more organized and more, you know, high end. And if online shopping is your thing, you know, certain sites like The RealReal or Tradesy or ThredUp, depending on like what are very well organized and easy to navigate.
I'm asking you this question, but it's really never been easier. Like,
it is a mental shift. It's it's a mental shift. And it's very overwhelming. It doesn't mean it's not overwhelming, because there's only one of everything. So it's definitely more complicated. It's not as easy as, you know, shopping in traditional stores necessarily, though a lot of brands are making it easier. I mean, as I said, I just came from the Real boutique in Soho, and that just looks like a regular boutique.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. Awesome. And I think you have an entire podcast episode about this question I'm going to ask next, and we'll link to that. But what do you tell people who just feel icky about it? Like, I think that's a big hurdle for some people. It's the only hurdle for a lot of people I know.
Totally. So the very first episode of It Never Gets Old, which I want to re-examine, is secondhand gross?
Yeah.
So I remember I was interviewed by like Man Repeller about secondhand, and the person was like, what if someone died in what you're wearing? And I was like, well, I never thought of it that way, but okay. you know, I am someone that loves storytelling and extending the lives of garments, but I totally understand why that would gross someone out. I think that, so actually I want to reexamine this and expand it, but I had a young woman test bacteria levels in new clothing that she got from a store and secondhand clothing. And the differences were very minimal. And then this was stuff like if you're going buying something in Bloomingdale's, like in the store, like other people have tried it on, the bacteria levels are actually very similar. And once you wash it, it eliminates it.
Okay.
However, we are in an era where there's more amazing secondhand than ever, depending on where you live too. If you're in New York, if you're in LA, you can go out to some of these stores. You could build an entire secondhand wardrobe of things with the tag still on them.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of people get rid of stuff that, like, you know, you think about all the time. Like, I've gotten rid of stuff with tags on. I'm like, man, I never wore this. This is really annoying.
Right. Something nice that I didn't bother returning and I don't want. Yeah.
So I would say that it is a mental barrier, but if you want to spend your whole time buying things like without tags, you know, with the tags on, or dry cleaning everything, then the bacteria drops to like the exact same.
Yeah, it's so funny because I was saying this to Ronnie earlier today, where like I have like a beautiful purebred dog, but I rescued him, and we were just saying like I wish if people wanted something really specific, they knew that they could look through that route too. And as you're like look at adopting instead of just buying, and I feel like it's sort of the same. If you want something, like just
maybe a good way to start is like, just check first. You probably will find what you're looking for, and it already exists.
100%. I mean, I have a secondhand dog also.
Yeah.
And yeah, no, who I think is she's a designer mix of something. But yeah, so that was really why I got into secondhand, was that like I wanted nice designer yes. stuff. I wanted all the stuff that I saw in stores that I couldn't yeah. afford or like had no business buying as a young person. And you can find anything secondhand, like yeah. unless it is was shown on a runway like last week. Like I will tell you, it's and people ask me this all the time. I got so many DMs asking to hunt for certain things, mm-hmm. whether it's like, you know, I'm dying for X leather jacket or I really want these boots. Like you can find, you can almost definitely find it secondhand. And I have a bazillion examples of I've done that for myself, and yeah. you can do it too. Like if there's a designer piece that you really want, like check the secondhand internet. Like mm-hmm. there's a strong chance that it yeah. exists already yeah. there for less. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes depending on it, you have wiggle room and can negotiate. Yeah. I mean, I go into this very extensively in a lot of different directions on Never Gets Old, but, that's what I want people to understand yeah. is that you can save money, you can make money on your wardrobe, you can, you know, care about the planet with this, but you can get designer stuff for so much less than retail yeah. just because like someone took it off a rack before totally. You.
Yeah. Yeah. Awesome. I think we'll end on that. Thank you so much, Meredith. Thank and Brag Biter comes out June 2020, right?
Yes,
yeah,
June 2020.
Yeah. You'll hear about it on the SUP when it does come out and on our Instagram and everything.
Amazing.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. You can pre-order Meredith Fineman's book, Brag Better, on Amazon now, and it comes out in June 2020.